Smart Counsel is a joint production of Multnomah University, Alternative Behavioral Therapy, and New Pattern Counseling. Joshua Moore is a counselor at Alternative Behavioral Therapy in Vancouver, Washington, who specializes in neurofeedback and trauma. Reese Pasimio is a counselor at New Pattern Counseling in Gresham, Oregon, who specializes in addictions, sexuality, gender, and spirituality. Thanks for listening and for joining the conversation.
Welcome to Smart Counsel, Family Systems and Addictions. Smart Counsel provides perspectives and resources for providers and students on spirituality, mental health, addictions, relationships, and trauma. I'm Reese Pasimio.
And I'm Joshua Moore.
And we are in the counseling office of the most excellent, most lovely Mary Jane Wilt. And hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I can pay you for that. All right. Later.
Yes, pay me in pecan bars.
So, it's funny because it's true.
Yeah. Thank you for having us into your office and thank you for being on our show.
Appreciate the invitation.
Yeah. So by means of introduction and check-in with everyone, what's everybody reading these days? Reading or learning or enjoying on Netflix?
Oh, there was something on Netflix the other day. We never actually asked it that way. Like, what are you watching on Netflix?
I haven't. Which there's not generally, well, I don't know if there's therapeutic value to that or not.
Well, I'll answer it nonetheless because I think it's fascinating.
Okay.
I just watched Binge Watch Mars, just one season. It's basically half documentary, half sci-fi, but it's actually very, very split. It's very, very, very much a documentary mixed with something that's kind of trying to predict what it would look like to try to colonize Mars.
Interesting.
But very, very, very much a documentary, despite the fact that it's also a sci-fi.
Okay.
I was taken by that because I love that stuff.
That's really fascinating. I'm just kind of fascinated by anything that suggests we're actually getting to where the Star Trek world is real. So, you know, flip phones warmed my heart for that reason. But anyway,
I do read a lot about that.
I know. My heart's been warm for a while.
Yeah, I remember when the EM drive got peer reviewed. I cracked that baby open and read the original research. It was hard. I had to look up like 40 terms before it even started to make a little sense. But yeah, we should talk.
Awesome. Well, speaking of Netflix, I mean, I was going to talk about like the Recovery Zone workbook I've been reading, but I did recently watch the whole season one of Russian Doll on Netflix. Ooh. Which it's fun. It's sort of like Groundhog Day with drugs.
Oh no.
But
psychedelic.
Is something like that. But it's interesting there's a sub character who's a therapist and is actually like kind of a legit therapist. And
really?
I'm almost tempted to say
like the first time ever.
For sure. It was like the best therapist I've ever seen in actually a TV show.
Wow.
I mean, she's like you meet her and she's doing EMDR and I think like legitly.
Wow.
And then the things that she says to the protagonist are actually kind of helpful and sensible things that a therapist might say.
That's impressive. Yes. You don't usually get that.
You don't usually get that. My favorite part is at some point the protagonist is saying like, oh, I'm crazy, crazy life, something, something. And this therapist is like, we don't say crazy in this house. And I'm cheering because I agree. We should not use the word crazy.
Okay.
Well, shoot, I was going to use that as a tagline. Like,
oh, no.
You have to be crazy to see me.
Okay.
That wouldn't work.
Anyway, so that's my media consumption lately.
Well, I have to add, I don't know if you're familiar with This Is Us, the series.
Oh, I've heard of it.
Yes.
It's phenomenal.
My brain's not reminding. What is it again?
So it's about really seamlessly woven between several generations mm-hmm. of this family system. And it really is about family systems. Mm. Unfortunately, there isn't a counselor, at least not so far, because they could really use one.
Yeah.
But there's just a lot of good family systems dynamics that are playing out on the show. And I've been hooked. I'm hooked.
Right. That's great. I feel like my wife's been watching that in the background. I don't think I've been directly watching it.
Yeah.
I've heard good things about it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's really great. I will say that some will say that it's kind of feminized. So it
they
might not
it
be
bit.
As.
What's yeah, that? They could use it a little bit.
Maybe a little. But that may be why your wife may be watching it in the background.
Perhaps,
it may not be as appealing for
it's,
you.
It's not, you know, EM drives and going to Mars, but that's fair.
Fair enough.
Well, I'm intrigued. So when I have time in that mythical, magical spot where I have time, I will keep it in mind.
Hypothetical.
Yeah, definitely. Speaking of family systems, love to hear a little bit more about you. I know a little bit about you, but let the listener know a little bit about who you are. What's your corner of the counseling world and why do you like family systems?
Well, I came a little bit late to the family systems game. I already had my license before I even realized that family systems was a thing. It was not, I had a family marriage and family class in grad school, but it really didn't touch on family systems. I came into it after reading The Dance of Anger by Harriet Lerner, who mentions Bowen family systems within the first 30 or 40 pages. And what she said about it so resonated with me that I just started grabbing up and reading everything I could possibly find on Bowen theory. And so what I really, it kind of put a final piece of the puzzle of how human beings work into place for me. I'd been in my own counseling process for, I think, 15 years prior to finding out about family systems and Bowen theory. And I was always searching for more, like there's something more that I'm missing. And that kind of locked that into place. And the way I describe it to people is that families operate a lot like birds do, and you can see them as a flock, you know, flying in the air, and they jolt, you know, they dart one way and go the other way in a split second on a dime. And I always wonder, like, what are they doing up there? How do they not run into each other and, you know, fall to the ground and get hurt? And they don't, you know, I guess they're honking up there and communicating apparently better than we do, because we also, as human beings, travel in packs, you know, what that we call families, and we bump into each other and we fall to the ground and we get hurt and we don't have a good repair process. And so, you know, that's kind of the pieces that Bowen Family Systems put into place for me, particularly because Bowen comes from a natural family systems perspective in that he tried to understand the human species as a kind of like an animal group, like how do monogamous mammals behave? And we happen to be, tend to be most of the time, at least serially monogamous mammals.
Right.
And so I really appreciated that perspective, you know, putting us into our mm-hmm. category, our group.
That does seem really useful, especially talking in terms of missing pieces. You can learn all you want about here's an individual person, their feelings, their thoughts, their triggers, their body sensations. But when you factor in their context, and I imagine there's both like the present context, who are you with now, as well as the historic context, what's your story, where have you come from? That does add a whole lot of dimension. It just for understanding who the person is. But then if you want to actually impact people.
Zoom out a little bit.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a, I think a lot about individual identity, but you have identities of families and identities of cultures. And I mean, there's a lot of things in between as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it'd be nice to hear a little more about that too. I also asked my students, ironically, just today, if they thought that there was a difference between individual intelligence and group intelligence and whether the two even correlated. Mm. It's not obvious whether they do or don't.
but you do see those patterns tend to run in families. Mm-hmm. Like this kind of family will have alcoholism running through it. This other family system will have sex abuse running through it. This other system will have sex addiction running through it. I mean, you know, and so there are these patterns that seem to fall into those family groups. I think every family has issues. We all have problems, but how we deal with them tends to be similar, you know, even across multiple generations. Mm. So, yeah.
So how do we change it?
How do you change it? I don't know. You're asking me.
Oh, no.
So I think family systems theory helps us see how patterns are operating. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily tell you the why. It kind of locked that piece in for me. Like, why do we behave this way? Oh, because we're a monogamous mammalian species and this is how we can. But in terms of individual families or individual people, it doesn't really explain the why. Mm. In fact, it's meant not to explain the why. We're just looking at what is happening. And we know how families operate best. And so we can compare what's happening to how an ideal family system would be operating and then compare the two. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't actually help us understand the why are they not operating
right.
ideally?
Right.
And so other modalities and other treatment.
I find why questions to be incredibly vexing anyways.
It's true.
You can only ask it a few times before you reach something impossibly complex.
Yeah.
And that's true about any part of life, in my opinion. Yeah.
It's not always the most relevant question either.
No. That's right. I mean, functional things.
I love a why question because I love a good story and a good mystery. But oftentimes it seems like if a person's in acute crisis, a why question isn't the most important how do you do things differently?
Exactly.
Maybe once they get stable and they want to do therapy for fun, they can talk about the why question.
Yeah, right. Maybe after we've solved the crisis or the problems.
Yeah. Although I wonder, so thinking about parent family systems with other modalities, say like narrative therapy, you know, when it comes to so family systems gives you a means to observe, here's a thing, here's a pattern, you know, no judgment, just neutral. Mm-hmm. If then another modality allows the opportunity to put the interpretation, the spin on it, that would be most beneficial. Yeah. And that might mean exchanging one for another. What do you say? Is that?
When you say exchanging one for another.
Well, like if I come from a, well, dysfunctional is probably too broad of a word. If I come from
we all get it.
Yeah, we do. I come from a family system with addiction in it, and I say, well, I observe that this is there. Don't necessarily know why at this point. And just the observation is not going to tell me what it means, but I could then say, well, this is objectively what my background is, but here's the significance I'm going to assign to it, or here's the direction that I want to go with it.
Yeah. So if someone were to come in and say, either I'm, you know, addicted to such and such, or my family tends to have this kind of addiction in it, how I would understand that, I guess maybe from a couple angles, I would start from the family systems angle and actually wonder what is that symptom trying to tell us about something that's gone awry? So we know how a family operates optimally. Addiction is not optimal. So I have to wonder how come, you know, what is that signaling in the family system that's not optimal? All right. So it I don't look at it as much as pathology, which of course it is, but more like this is an anxiety, like a sore, you know, and there's a reason that sore is there. It's trying to highlight some problem. And so if we can identify what's going wrong in the system because the signal has called it out, then we can move again toward what is optimal in terms of functioning as a group together. Mm-hmm. We have this teamwork that we have to do, and we're not doing our teamwork well. And this addiction here is showing us that we're missing something. Mm-hmm. We have to find, you know, the solution to that.
So things like addiction or things like faulty communication patterns or excessive conflict, those themselves are not the problem. They're indicative of other problems, maybe related to attachment or some
potentially
other
even anxiety.
Yeah. Right.
I think anxiety, especially actually, I mean, if you think about anxiety broadly, that describes everything, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's just a stress point, you know? And so all of these ways that we express that anxiety are just different ways of expressing anxiety.
Yeah.
Addiction is one of them. Yeah. So
I like how you put that. And I would, with addiction, I would generally say addiction is rarely a primary problem anyway. It's always indicative of other deeper problems. So, so, you know, there's a deeper problem that causes addiction, that causes family dysfunction. And so you just trace that backward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And unfortunately, we often look at the addiction, or at least in the culture at large, looks at the addiction as the problem, or the person who has the addiction as the problem. Whereas if you look from a family systems perspective, we're all in this. And if one person has a problem, it's a problem in the whole. And we all have to figure out how we're going to contribute to the solution.
I wonder if we could dig into this a little bit, because there's a really important tension going on there that comes up for sure in recovery conversations, where when you have an individual addicted person, you know, a lot of times part of their process is taking responsibility for self, not blame shifting, owning, here's what I've done, here's how I've impacted the people around me, here's my own feelings, and I, no one has made me and no one's going to fix me. I'm on my individual journey, which is true. And it's an important move for an addicted person to take that ownership. The tension, though, is that each individual exists in a context.
That's right.
And in some of my, you know, sex and porn specific conversations, it's the context of a couple. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times, you know, any sort of addiction happens in the context of, it could be a couple, it could be parents, could be kids, could be siblings. And so, well, we would never say it's the partner's fault that the person addicts, or it's never the family's fault, air quotes. We would recognize that the family is part of it in a way, or for sure they're part of the recovery process.
Absolutely part of the solution.
Yeah. I want to know, what are some of your thoughts about that tension? How do you navigate that?
It's a great question. I am completely on board with that idea that we all have to take our own personal responsibility for, you know, how we express our anxiety. You know, we have to own that, whether that's addiction or, you know, some sort of neurosis, something like that. Let's take sex addiction, for example, which I do specialize in that. I have some special certification to work with sex addicts and their families. And so when there's been some sort of betrayal, sexual betrayal, relationship betrayal, that actually has to take precedence over the coupleship restoring their relationship. So say a couple comes in without that kind of issue, we're going to start talking about the conflict patterns or, you know, that sort of thing between them and just go right into relational recovery kind of work. When you have a betrayal or some, you know, it doesn't even have to be sex addiction, but something, let's say gambling, even like the family savings is now no longer, you actually have to deal with that betrayal and the lying and the deception first, and make sure that trust has been reestablished before you can even begin to work with the relational dynamics that didn't cause the original addiction, but certainly may have contributed to the anxiety of the person who's expressing their anxiety through addiction.
Yeah. So if there's a flashpoint event, that event needs to be stabilized first.
Absolutely.
And then it's in that stabilization of a flashpoint that it would be really toxic, damaging to blame the partner or at all infer, you know, partner, it was your fault. But once that's stable, and that could take, you know, months, years, however long.
Yeah, exactly.
Then you can look at the whole context, and that's when you could more safely explore, now, how did everybody participate in the context?
Yeah. And the hope in that is that when that happens, when you have a couple who gets to that point, where they're ready to do some relationship recovery, it represents that a lot of healing has already occurred between them in the trust department, so that their relationship itself feels different to them than it was even before they discovered the addiction. So it's like, yeah, we've been married twice, you know, to the same person, you know, it's a whole different relationship. Really, no matter what the betrayal was, you know, when they get to that point of establishing something new.
So with family systems, a couple of questions come into mind.
Yeah.
One is, does a family systems practitioner practice exclusively family systems, or is it a conglomeration of a couple of different theories? And within that, what are some realistic goals, expectations, outcomes for a family systems oriented course of treatment?
Yeah, great question. I don't know that any therapist practices purely one modality.
I figured.
They may say that they do, but I really doubt that.
I was kind of thinking about like Gestalt. Was he totally original or was he borrowing from like five or six other people?
We all steal.
I had a student ask me last week, well, when do you have your own theory? Well, when you stick your fingers in your ears and you ignore everybody and you keep yelling, I have my own theory.
Yeah.
That's when you have your own theory.
Yeah, that exactly.
Tends to be kind
exactly.
Of
and nobody
dangerous.
Believes you anyway.
No. So. Eventually it'll stick, you know, it did for a number of people.
Yeah. I can say that when, I eventually had the privilege of doing some training at the Bowen Center in Washington, DC.
Wow.
I did. Yes. So I decided that to really test this theory, I needed to do it within my family of origin. So I actually closed down my practice in Portland, Oregon and moved for 3 years out to Philadelphia, where the suburbs of Philly, where I grew up, to do that research, to do that testing within my family of origin. And when I was there, within about a couple hours of Washington, D.C. So I was able to go to the training center there. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, the folks there would say they practice Bowen purely.
Yes.
I think that, I mean, that's their mission. Their yeah. mission is to disseminate Bowen theory in as pure form as possible. But what's really cool about Bowen is he always said this cannot be a closed system. If you allow this right. to be a closed system and you don't allow it to be tested or informed by, you know, science as we continue to grow, it will become defunct. Mm-hmm. And so I don't practice it purely. I do tend to see it as a great framework to start with. And then probably most commonly, I'll add in attachment stuff. Attachment, mm-hmm. I think, is another theory that Bowen and Bowlby were contemporaries, exact contemporaries. They actually died in the same year, mm-hmm. 1990. They weren't necessarily informed by each other. I don't think they ever met. But you will read in Bowen material, the phrase something like, unresolved attachment issues, you know, from family of origin. So I don't know if that was just part of the scientific community, the psychological community at the time, that that was sort of the vernacular of the time, but certainly.
They both had some unconscious plagiarism of each
maybe,
other.
Maybe, maybe. Yeah, that wouldn't surprise yeah. me. Yeah,
or just intuitively, there's going to be overlap anyway, because right. these two concepts, they are speaking to the heart of very similar mm-hmm. things.
And mm-hmm. yeah, we're all trying to understand human beings and how we work and yeah. how we operate and what goes wrong. Yeah.
And mm-hmm. those initial mm-hmm. connections, right. those family connections, the context of a person is huge. So probably anyone exploring that is going to have similar ideas, whether they're emphasizing like the attachment of the family. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would see like Bowen was really studying adults looking backward. And Bowlby was looking at infants mm-hmm. and trying to understand how the patterns in early childhood would potentially, he was trying to be predictive about the future of a child whose attachment system was less than ideal.
Yeah.
And so I think they were just looking at the same mountain from a different angle, you know, chronologically. And so they really do seem to blend well together. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes I will frame up the family systems material for clients. And then we're going back to that early childhood stuff and seeing, you know, how it transpired. Where, you know, how was the attunement in that early family system?
Mm-hmm. We've been tossing around Bowen's name a little bit and talking about Bowen theory, which is this, the family systems theory. Family systems theory. Yes. Okay. If we haven't said it already, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Bowen theory and what are, you know, what's the crux of it, you know, a couple of key components, you know, the buzzwords.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so, Bowen's, work began mostly with families with a schizophrenic member. And so he was trying to understand how this thing developed or how it could diminish within the system and so on. And in families with a schizophrenic member, he found there to be high anxiety. So just an incredible. And so his theory was really meant to minimize or find ways to decrease that anxiety. So anxiety is kind of like a key variable mm-hmm. in his work. He came as he was working with thousands of couples, actually, between I think it was 1950 and 1954. He was working with families all together. They would come to the place where it was where was it? I forget the hospital where. Oh, the Menninger Clinic. And they would come as whole families and work there with him. And he was noticing these patterns and he was cataloging that just there's actually a whole section of a library with all of his material. And he was just, you know, voraciously studying these families and making records of them. And he found over time, six ways or six kind of common factors that family systems sort of exhibited. And the first three are really the most important. And so he recognized that different families have varying levels of what he called differentiation, which is the ability to be to know who you are and maintain a grip on who you are in the presence of others in relationship, particularly in your family of origin, where you learned, you know, how you were supposed to act, whether that created anxiety for you or not, you kind of knew how you were supposed to act. And if that doesn't kind of fit with who you experience yourself to be, that's going to create some anxiety. So the whole issue of differentiation is kind of like the cornerstone of his theory. Second tenet in the theory is around triangles. So differentiation, like if I'm in relationship with another person, we would call that a dyad. And a triangle is when there's so much tension between you and me. I don't know what to do with it. I don't know how to solve it. We're not able to resolve it together. So we siphon off some of that tension on a third party, or a behavior, or really anything can be that third leg of the triangle. Mm-hmm. And that's a way to decrease the tension between us, and still maintain the relationship.
How does that work? I think it sounds like something well. You describe something that sounds like the drama triangle. At least that's what I think I refer to.
Well, isn't that it's sort of similar to the apartment triangle?
Yeah,
that's what I was thinking. That's where we get roles like, you know, rescuer, martyr, scapegoat,
that's right.
The clown.
Yeah. Which you might have in any one family system. Everybody's sort of trading those roles to get the tension to decrease, or to get the problem resolved, or whatever. But basically, when people are having incredible tension between them, particularly a mom and a dad, the easiest person to triangle with is one of the kids. And so, yeah, one of the poor kids. So the kids then, a kid is usually, there's usually one within let's say there's three kids, usually one of them will become the focal point of mom and dad who can't resolve this tension, all right? That child will then continue to bear that weight, and will eventually develop symptoms. Okay. So that symptom would be one of those signals I mentioned earlier, like something in this group has gone awry. It's not ideal. We have to get this resolved. So when there's a kid who's acting out, in my mind, when I'm thinking family systems, I'm thinking this is simply highlighting a problem in the whole, probably an issue between mom and dad that hasn't gotten resolved. Okay. So differentiation, triangulation was the second concept. I should have brought my mug in here where I stamped into it all of the eight. There's eight principles. He started with six. The nuclear family process. So the nuclear family process is what I described with the flock of birds earlier, that everybody's impacting one another. Like there's this, and the way we impact one another is through our emotional system. Okay. So there's emotions that are contagious in a family system. And when one person's having stress, everybody feels it. Mm-hmm. We react to it, we respond to it, and everybody then responds to whoever's kind of acting out, and it can escalate that way. So if you get those three principles, you can almost anticipate the others. So the next one would be multi-generational family system issues where you see the same issues in one generation from previous generations. Yep. You can just see it fall all the way through.
Curious. This is something I know very, very little about, disclaimer. But I was wondering if it'll ever follow more complex patterns, like where it will bounce back and forth between like a polar negative. So like my parents beat me, so I never discipline my kids. And then the cycle starts to almost like have a sinus wave. It's going back and forth.
Great point. Yeah, absolutely. And so what needs to happen then, like in the ideal family system, what you have is two secure parents. So you can hear the attachment language there. Two differentiated parents who aren't responding to their own unresolved needs from their own history, but are able to dial into the real needs of the child. Mm-hmm. All right.
Right.
So the child will have developmental needs. We can kind of know how developmental cycles go and, what kids should be doing at a certain point. And recognize, say, for example, at two, this child is acting out, that may not be highlighting a problem in the family system. That mm-hmm. may be what two-year-olds do to figure out who they are.
Yeah.
You know? And so if mom is worried, you know, that, oh no, my child seems to be pulling away from me, I feel abandoned, she may be projecting right. onto that child then right. needs that the child doesn't really have. Like mm-hmm. that child actually needs to be acting out mm-hmm. so it can figure out what the boundaries are.
Great.
Yeah, yeah, so it can get pretty complex.
Mm.
Yeah,
but they're still in that time. You're describing someone who's still reacting to their own story.
That's right.
You know, it's just the kid isn't really a necessary variable.
That's right. Yeah, you know? Yeah, a very unnecessary
yeah.
variable.
Very.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So then, thinking about what's most needful for parents raising small children, it would be or raising big children too.
Yeah, right.
But it would, you know, more than any like specific, hey, communicate this way, discipline this way, it'd be. You know your own stuff, know mm-hmm. your own triggers,
right on.
And be able to, you know, suspend your own issues long enough to mm-hmm. attune to the child, mm-hmm. address them and what they are actually experiencing and they're actually needing.
Mm-hmm. Gary Landreth once said, the best gift you can give your child is a healthy you.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I could see that.
That's
yeah.
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think for parents to get that zoomed out perspective a little bit, that when a child seems to be acting out, hear that or see that as a mm-hmm. signal that something might be awry in the whole that they might simply not see.
I love how you framed that. Like, I think I'm like integrating that into my own schema now.
Something might no, be awry good. In the whole. Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. I could see where that could be really useful because that's, I could see that sort of moment being really hard for a parent being like,
yeah.
you know, they're, you know, the parent's irrational, you know, self going quickly to someone thinks I'm a bad parent or I think I'm a bad parent. And that's just super crisis for any parent.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, it's not that they're on their own a bad parent. It's that, well, maybe they are missing some skills here and there, but it's really the whole system. And it's not just their, you know, household unit, but it's their whole context, their whole family is of origins that they've come from. So blaming oneself excessively probably isn't productive
right.
either.
No. And I think one thing that Bowen was really clear about is that these patterns happen in normal families,
mm-hmm.
in really solid families, just to a much lesser degree. So triangulation is going to happen. In fact, you can use triangulation if you're connected to your extended family system, which he would say is ideal.
Mm-hmm.
You have more places that you can siphon off some of that tension. Like your dad and I need to have a date night, so you're going to go to the grandparents, mm-hmm. you know, kind of thing. And so you can, that's what family systems are for. It's why we group. It's why we come mm-hmm. together, you know, for community and help and interdependence and all of that kind of thing.
So that adage or that cliche, it takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah.
There's actually some family system value to that.
That's right.
In that it's not just an isolated family. I think I've heard this, well, on a lot of levels, like, you know, individuals on their own don't do so well. Couples on their own have, you know, a special type of problem, you know, family systems that are super isolated. They have a special kind of problem. So,
yeah. And that's unfortunate
yeah.
because families problem, really are meant challenge. To help each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't imagine my own personal world without the entire system. Like, I feel like if you took one ingredient out, it would just collapse. Mm-hmm. Maybe it wouldn't, mm-hmm. but it feels like it would.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's why you see in a family system, mm-hmm. like when someone dies, for example, there's this upheaval that happens in the family for sometimes years,
mm-hmm.
At least one, you know, and
yeah.
because that role, was important.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing happens when there's an addition to the family, either a baby or say someone gets married,
mm-hmm.
you have this jockeying, you know, that mm-hmm. happens in patterns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
I'm thinking about cultural trends, sociological trends, also thinking about your family, Josh, comparing yours and mine a little bit. because I know your extended family is very local to you.
Yes.
And always has
been. Yes. And it's a huge, like, I had a lot of opportunities to leave the area and do very well. And I can't I've had some pretty big people up there offer me jobs in like Seattle or California. And I said no to everything because family's here.
Yeah.
And I will not adjust. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't have to, I won't mm-hmm. do it.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, for me, so my immediate family unit moved away from our extended family cluster when I was four. So I never had local grandparents, aunts, or uncles.
Yeah.
And then I've lived long distance from my immediate family for, you know, a decade and a half now.
Mm.
And so in one sense, that's kind of normalized for me to just be the kind of, you know, the lone Pissimeo in the Pacific Northwest. which thank you.
We're wiping our tears.
We are. We're wiping our tears.
Thanks. But it's funny, and it's been this funny bit of reflection for me, because on one sense that's been normal for me, but then it's recently occurred to me maybe that's not ideal, and there's these weird subtle underpinnings of isolation and just like aloneness that I feel.
Well,
and,
not to get too deep here, but I think that's going to be most obvious when your kids are your age. And you're playing the role that you didn't get.
Sure.
Yeah. Maybe
that's
so.
That's when it'll be like, oh my goodness, I didn't have something.
Yeah. Oh, the counter transference.
True.
Yeah.
It is true.
Yeah. So there's definitely things to consider, you know, what's that going to be like for me raising kids, and, you know, what sort of extended family system values are my kids going to absorb, because they don't really have any extended family around them.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the other variables I'm wondering about too is, because I notice a lot of people in my friend circles and my client circles who are, you know, the lone member of their family, or they've been cut off from their family for this or that reason, and either, you know, unfortunate case scenario, don't have anybody, or more fortunate case scenario, they have what is getting called chosen family. They've got, you know, a couple of good friends, maybe a faith community or a recovery community or something. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, would the family systems dynamics start to come to life in a non-biologically united community, do you think?
It would. I mean, you can see that even before you get to that level where, you know, we're part of our original family system, and then we, most of us anyway, pair up, we pair bond, and and we see the same conflicts already there almost immediately within 6 or 18 months,
right?
You know, that we...
If you're wherever you go,
resolve.
There you are.
Yeah, wherever you go, there you are. Yeah. So you will see that. So there was a time, what was it, in the 90s maybe, where there were a lot of the communities kind of springing up that they found the same thing, that just because they're sharing in common doesn't mean that, and they have a really important value there of community and supporting one another and so on, you still have the same conflicts and you would expect that. I would expect that just because we're human. But again, I wouldn't necessarily see the conflicts that arise as problems. Mm-hmm. I would see them as highlighting something that simply isn't ideal, you know? And so we have to look at that and kind of ask what isn't going ideal? What needs to go better here?
Yeah. And now I'm starting to see a lot of the overlap with addictions work, where in one sense, so you talked a lot about anxiety as a key driver in any family system. And the measures we go to reduce anxiety really come out in the open, and kind of similar talking about any sort of addictive compulsive behavior. It's all about alleviating anxiety, coming back to homeostasis in some way, coping with reality. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely, you know, that common thread. But with this idea too of whatever patterns are in my family, I'll tend to play those out in any group, in any diet I come across. There's a way I'm thinking about, I've been reading up a little bit on like cross addictions and covert addictions, and how, you know, you can stop drinking or stop looking at porn or stop, you know, gambling or something, and you know, give up one object of addiction. But then unless you're really looking inward, you're going to pick up another object of addiction, obsession. And that could be an emotion, a relationship.
Exercising. You
know, exercising.
Smoking.
Yeah.
It could be something that looks good. I mean, a lot of people. I can say for myself, just compulsively, like in school, educated, reading, you know. I spent so much time.
You're targeting me, aren't you? Stop doing that.
So it can even look good. Our addictions can look good. Church, you know, people
very
can, there's
so.
A really wonderful book by Leo Booth called When God Becomes a Drug.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, so it's possible to use even good things in a way that they were never intended to be used. Yeah.
So similar to, so thinking, how do you break out of those addictive patterns and finally establish a healthy relationship with whatever the object is? And I guess similar to in a family system, how do you break out of a dysfunctional-ish pattern or like a disconnective pattern and finally start to have like a more productive, I don't know, what's the right word? Productive, healthy?
You think healthy?
Yeah.
Would that be the opposite of the dysfunctional word that we were using earlier?
Maybe.
I think healthy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so I would say two things about that. We can, an unhealthy pattern in most cases would be to cut off, which would be another one of those tenets of the Bowen theory, one of those eight, where if let's say I was the problem child or the hero child, I was the one who was most focused on in the family, which it doesn't matter either direction, good or bad. The child who's most focused on tends to do the least well in life. They end up saddled with the anxiety of the family system, and they often cut off from the family to get breathing, breathe air, mm-hmm. I got to get out of here, And so they cut off either emotionally or physically, sometimes both. That would be would represent an unhealthy fix, if you will, difficulty.
That would be the negative identity formation.
And then so what would be the other side of that coin, I guess, would be grieving the losses that were part of the family system growing up that left us with wounds that were untended. Mm-hmm. So it's really a grieving process, and that's painful. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense then why people skip from one addiction to another, as opposed to actually dealing with the pain that the addiction tries to cover over.
Yeah. I was just talking with my supervisor actually about the importance of addressing grief in an addictions context in particular, but it sounds like it's coming up here too, recognizing my family wasn't perfect. My attachment wasn't perfect. I was failed in some ways. I've lost some things, and I could just angrily cut myself off, which isn't really a long-term fix, but it'll feel kind of good in the moment. Or I can actually face it last, cry about it, rage about it a little bit, but then be able, it sounds like after that, be able to turn around and potentially reestablish a reinvented, reimagined relationship with the original family.
If they're willing.
If they're willing, yeah.
Obviously, forgiveness takes one, reconciliation takes two.
Yeah.
And if they're willing, that could happen. They would have to go through that hard, painful work too. And you don't see that very much.
Right.
So a lot of times we're left with this hole, this void that doesn't get filled. But the grieving process itself changes us. It softens us. It brings us closer and closer to who we would have been mm-hmm. had the wound not occurred, had the breach of the relationship not occurred. So we become whole, more whole. We become more of who we would have become. And so that, I think, would be the healthy adaptation.
Yeah.
It's painful, but it at least has a redemptive value to that pain.
Yeah.
Where addiction would not, or some sort of anxiety or neurotic response would not.
Yeah. That's super important. And now I'm feeling inspired to talk more about families with people, and actually I'm thinking about
them. I am as well.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking about the men's process group I do, and I'm thinking, ooh, we could talk about grief, we could talk about family, we could, because they're already kind of primed for that. So it'll be great.
Well, yeah, and I'm regularly working on family systems because of neurofeedback.
Yeah, right.
I would say assume, and I'm not right half the time, but I assume half the time what happens is people who are coming in for neurofeedback are coming in to get something fixed and they're really avoiding something else. And I still want to help calm the nervous system and, but I don't want to miss the opportunity of just treating a symptom. Does that make sense? Because usually they're avoiding the systems work. So, I mean, I do a little bit of systems work, but I should get some more formal training on it. And I really like how you framed a lot of things. I feel like I've learned a lot today.
Awesome.
So a couple of questions in closing. One, if you were speaking to the counseling student who may be listening and the practitioner who's established but maybe thinking, I should do some of the family stuff. What are, a couple quick reasons why, yes, you absolutely should do this?
Well, I don't know what someone might be motivated for, but mine was just that missing piece. It's like, I needed to understand the bigger picture, not just these techniques and theories, but, really why. And so, I have found that my clients, when I'm using, kind of a hallmark of family systems is genograms or family diagrams. When I'm using my whiteboard to map out a family system,
I'm noticing that one whole wall of your office is whiteboard. I love it.
And I use it extensively. And whenever I go to the board, it's like the attention is riveted in a way that just talking doesn't manage to do. There's something about seeing your own family on the board.
Well, having a whole wall makes it like you could just casually stand up and start mapping it while you're talking. I can't do that without a wall of drywall. Dry paint. What do you call that?
Yeah, that's whiteboard paint.
There's a whiteboard paint. Mm-hmm. I want to do that in my office now.
Yeah. It's phenomenal. I love it.
Cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
I might do that too. Other question. What's a book or two, a podcast or two, a resource or two that's really good for just an introduction into the family systems theory or Bowen's theory?
So for Bowen theory, I think the easiest, most of Bowen stuff is for clinicians, unfortunately. But there's a book called by Roberta Gilbert, Extraordinary Relationships. It's an oldie but goodie. And another one that's more client oriented, like really, really simple and even exercise in it, is called Family Ties That Bind, mm-hmm. the fourth edition by Ronald Richardson. Highly recommend both of those resources. Another one by Jenny Brown. Jenny Brown is called Growing Yourself Up, and it's about differentiation across the lifespan. And then the BowenCenter.org is probably the most succinct, boring place where you can find good information on Bowen theory.
Well, if it wasn't boring, it wouldn't be credible.
The theory tab.
The theory tab. Okay.
On that website is awesome.
Right. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you. And for the listener just meeting you now, again, what are your credentials? What are the services you offer? And how could someone get a hold of you?
Can't find me. I'm in Portland, Oregon. I'm a licensed professional counselor in LPC. I'm in school right now. I'm in my PhD program, so for marriage and family. So it'll cool. be I'll also be an LMFT at some point.
Yeah, nice. Go! Woot,
woot. You both have fun with that.
My website mjlpc.com. Mm-hmm. So there's some family system stuff on there and ways to contact me if more information is desired.
All right,
coolio. Well. Thank you again. I've learned a lot and this has been fun. Mm-hmm. And thank you for all of the work that you do and the contributions you make to the community.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Dear listeners, thanks for listening along and please do rate and review us. That's really helpful. Even if you disagree with us, it's still a conversation. So leave us a note and let's keep the conversation going.
We love your feedback. So let's keep the conversation going. Follow Smart Counsel on Facebook at Smart Counsel Podcast, on Twitter at Smart Counsel 601. And you can email your questions to smartcounselpodcast@gmail.com. Our theme music is by Nate Botsford. Our logo design is by Thomas Moore.
This podcast was edited and produced by breakfastpuppies.com.